Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. What text number? 24 is correct. Taiva Veda Durme Dire. Daryante Purushaya Yata Evam Chakara Bhagavan Vyasak Pripana Vatsalaha Ta eva Veda Durme Dire Dharayante Purushaya Yatha Evam Chakara Bhagavan Vyasak Kripanavatsalaha Te that Eva certainly Vedaha The Book of Knowledge. Durmid higher by the less intellectual. Daryante can assimilate. Purushai by the man. Yata as much as. Eva thus. Chakara edited Bhagavad the powerful Vyasa the great sage Vyasa Kriponavatsalaha very kind to the ignorant mass. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Thus the great sage Vyasadeva, who is very kind to the ignorant masses, edited the Vedas so they might be assimilated by less intellectual men. Purport. The Veda is one, and the reasons for its divisions in many parts are explained herewith. The seed of all knowledge, or the Veda, is not a subject matter which can easily be understood by an ordinary man. There is a stricture that no one should try to learn the Vedas who is not a qualified Brahmana. This stricture has been wrongly interpreted in so many ways. A class of men who claim Brahminical qualifications simply by their birthright in the family of a Brahmana claim that the study of the Vedas is a monopoly of the Brahmin caste only. Another section of the people take this as an injustice to members of other castes who do not happen to take birth in a Brahmin family. But both of them are misguided. The Vedas are subjects which had to be explained even to Brahmaji by the Supreme Lord. Therefore, the subject matter is understood by persons with exceptional quality of goodness. Persons who are in the modes of passion and ignorance are unable to understand the subject matter of the Vedas. The ultimate goal of Vedic knowledge is Sri Krishna, the personality of Godhead. This personality is very rarely understood by those who are in the modes of passion and ignorance. In the Satya Yuga, everyone was situated in the mode of goodness. Gradually, the mode of goodness declined during the Treta and Dwapara Yugas, and the general mass of people became corrupt. In the present age, the mode of goodness is almost nil. And so for the general mass of people, the kind-hearted, powerful sage, Srila Vyasadeva, divided the Vedas in various ways so that they may be practically followed by less intelligent persons in the modes of passion and ignorance. It is explained in the next shlokas as follows. Vyasa, there's a title. There's not just one Vyasa. As explained in the Vishnu Purana, at the end of every Dwarpa Yuga, there is need for the same function. Vyasa, as title, means one who divides. Vyasyate. Samasyate Vyasyate. You put words together into samasas. You take them apart is Vyasa, the opposite. Dividing up. Words are mixed up, separate them. That's Vyasa. So as actually explained like that by Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur in his Bhagavatam commentary. Actually, there always are four Vedas. They're eternal. Chaturveda is not something that only came into being 5,000 years ago. But the separating into different volumes is new. The example is given, especially as the time moves on through the ages, by the time Kali Yuga is about to begin, everything's mixed up. Everything in the world, including Vedic knowledge. Confused. It's described like a man who is very rich and he possesses a treasure house full of jewels. But they're out of order. Everything's mixed up. He doesn't know what he has in there. Just a big pile of jewels, all mixed up. So he hires a reliable person to come to his treasure house who can be trusted not to pocket the jewels, stick them in his pocket. A trustworthy person to sort out the jewels. Put the diamonds in one pile, the sapphires in another, emeralds in another, rubies in a fourth pile. That's what Vyasadeva does. Especially by the end of the Dwarpa Yuga, the Vedas are all mixed up. Of course, all the Vedic texts are never completely manifested on the earth. It's not that Vedas are missing, but there are many versions of each Veda, shakas. And not all the shakas, not all the parts of all the shakas are available. Especially Kali Yuga, less and less. By the time of Kali Yuga, the least fraction of the Vedas are available. There's enough to piece together a decent sacrifice, but you have to choose from this shaka, that shaka, the pieces missing here, you have to pull it from over there. All the pieces of all the shakas are not there. And many shakas, or branches, of each Veda are missing completely. Especially in Kali Yuga. But still you have a big pile of mantras, all mixed up. So Vyasadeva comes and resorts them. There are four Vedas eternally. There are four different priests who each participate in the yajna by chanting their own kinds of mantras. The mantras are actually of different kinds, just like the jewels are different chemical substances. Actually, they're all quartz. They're all carbon with some mixture of other minerals. But the mixture makes a difference. Different colors, different hardness, different refraction of light, different qualities of the jewels because of slight contamination of the carbon with other elements and molecules. Well, the Vedas are one in the absolute sense, but there are four, basically four different kinds of mantras. The Rig Veda mantras are chanted by the Hota priests. It's a specialization. Someone who's really brilliant can study more than one Veda and become a Dvivedi Chaturvedi. In Kali Yuga, the Chaturvedis mostly are just such by name. Mathura, they're called Chaube, is the Prakrit version of Chaturvedi. Families are originally known as Chaube, and in the more modern times, they rename it Chaturvedi, make it sound more Sanskrit. But really, the families are Chaube, which is the Prakrit corruption of Chaturvedi. And nowadays, I doubt you can find me, anyone in Mathura, among the Chaturvedis, who knows even one Veda, or even knows a few mantras from one Veda. What to speak of knowing all four Vedas? It's just a name. But originally, it really marked somebody. A Dvivedi was someone who didn't specialize in only one shaka, or one Veda, but he knew more than one. But the standard procedure is to divide up the labor, and the Hota priest chants the Hota priests in the sacrifice. This isn't a big sacrifice where you have more than one priest. He chants the mantras from his Rig Veda. And the Rig Veda mantras are in a special language, different than the language of the other Vedas. And they serve a different purpose. Rig Veda mantras are to invite the demigods to glorify them and make them feel comfortable as guests in the sacrifice. The Yajurveda mantras are chanted by the Advaryu priests. These are the magic incantations by which the sacrificial environment is created, by which you turn ordinary sticks and pots into something transcendental by chanting mantras. These mantras are different. The Yajurveda mantras are not measured according to Vedic meters. The meter is just prose, not poetry. Different language for a different purpose. Magic or creative language. Just like a judge in a court, in its official capacity, tells to one couple, "I now declare you man and wife." And the next man who comes before him, he says, "I sentence you to be hanged by your neck until you're dead. May God have mercy on your soul." So by what he says, he's creating the reality. It's, marriage or death is created by the words, magic words. This is the kind of language you find in the Yajurveda. Samaveda is for entertainment of the demigods' song based on the Rig Veda mantras. The Atharva Veda is especially incantations for undoing mistakes and inauspicious situations. Different language. So the different mantras always exist, but sometimes a situation evolves where they're all mixed up. And it's hard for less intelligent people to sort them out. Therefore, Vyasadeva does the sorting for them. Durme dire, less intelligent people, which is what we basically have in Kali Yuga. People are generally less intelligent than they used to be, a lot less intelligent. And then there are a few people, even in Kali Yuga, who are not so stupid, relatively speaking. The PhDs and the philosophers, they're actually stupid because they're Kali Yuga philosophers and Kali Yuga professors. Kali Yuga brahmanas. But relatively, they're more smart than the ignorant mass. It's the less ignorant intelligentsia, not so ignorant. That's Kali Yuga. But there are a few people in Kali Yuga who can follow the Vedas. But most people can't. They need special help. In fact, what's needed is the explanation given in the Itihasa and Puranas. That will be described in the next verse, explaining why and how Vyasadeva created the Mahabharata, wrote the Mahabharata. Because even though he has arranged the Vedas for simpler understanding, still, most people can't follow. First of all, there are very few actually qualified brahmanas who are competent and allowed to study these Vedas, there's a lot of lower class people, Stri, Shudra, Dwija Bandhu, lower class and unqualified, untrained members of the Brahmin families. For them, Mahabharata and the Puranas are there. Itihasa Purana Abhyam, Vedam, Samapubrimhayet. Bibed Yalpashutad Veda, Mamayam Chalayasyati. Itihasa Purana Abhyam, Vedam, Samapubrimhayet. The Vedas, as Kali Yuga is coming around, the Veda Purusha is worrying that these rascals, these atheists, these materialists, are going to misinterpret me, misrepresent me. What am I going to do? So the arrangement is made by Lord Narayan that the Itihasas and Puranas come to the rescue. They're also eternal, but they serve a special purpose. There's a special need for them in the Kali Yuga. By the Itihasa and Purana, the Vedas are made complete. Whatever discrepancy or whatever is missing or whatever cannot be understood clearly is explained, is filled in by the Itihasa, the epic histories, meaning Mahabharata and Ramayana especially, and the Puranas. Without those literatures, people cannot understand the Vedic knowledge. They have no access, proper access to the Vedic knowledge in Kali Yuga. Because they're all Durmeda. Prayen alpayashak sabya kalavasmin yuge jana manda sumanda matayo manda bhagya hi upadrutaha. Upadrutaha. People are generally, they don't live very long. So they don't have much time for their business. And they usually spend, you know, 10 to 20 years going to school, which for most people is unnecessary and a waste. Modern school systems are just prisons to keep young people off the streets. It's not legal to send them to factories anymore in the most countries. So lock them up in the schools. Keep them out of the job market for a while and keep them off the streets. Send them to these prisons called schools. Where they can learn how to be good demons. Yeah. Docile, productive workers and consumers. And they can learn all that in school. Anyway, they don't live very long. So they spend 10 to 20 years in the school. Even a person who can't even read or write a proper sentence, he's getting a master's degree at some university. In America, there's so many universities. Anyone can go to a university. Even if you can't get into a good one, you can find a lousy one. There's a book, forgot the name of it, that described the sorry state of education in America. That there are a few good schools where you can actually learn something. And the rest of it is called Academic Siberia. And he said, this is not really a fair name. Because there are actually many good schools in Siberia. You know, it's not fair to call it that. These schools where you don't really learn much. They just put you there. And you party almost every night and you know, don't learn very much. And the teachers don't know very much anyway. But the time is wasted going to school, even if there's no good reason for it, for most people. And then after you get out of school, you got to get a job and work for 30, 40 years at the job. And then you retire and go to a retirement home in Palm Beach or someplace. And that's it. All your time has been used up, wasted. You only add 70, 80, 85 years, and you've wasted all of it. So where's the time to study the Vedas? Maybe there are a few professors in the universities who are studying the Vedas, because they get paid for that. They have no faith in the Vedas. They're experts in critical study of the Vedas, which means to reject their authority and tear them apart. Like the biologists who kill a frog and cut up his guts to study what's inside. So like that, they stick a pin through the Vedas, soak it in formaldehyde, kill it, and cut it apart and see what's inside. What are you going to find? You know, frogs jump, but your dead frog doesn't jump. You know, you can cut him up. You'll never see how a frog jumps. Or the other things a frog does when he's alive. You can't see a dead frog swallow a fly. Similarly, your academic study of the Vedas won't reveal anything what they're actually about. And then there are a few lucky brahmanas who actually study the Vedas. They're very intelligent. Many of them are very pious, but they're like living in the wrong times. Studying the Vedas and the Vedanta Sutra, what use is it to anybody in the modern age? Who cares about the Vedas and Vedanta Sutra? You may be expert, but what good will it do to anybody? Because nobody's interested. You become an expert in a subject, even if you have, you're a proper Brahmin, that you actually studied the Vedas, you studied the Vedanta Sutra, or maybe Mimamsa or something else. But who cares? Who needs it in Kali Yuga? What, you know, who will take advantage of your knowledge? Who can make use of it? Okay, in the courts, when they're following Hindu law, they actually use the interpretive principles of Karma Mimamsa, of Jaimini Mimamsa, to decide law cases. Okay, so a few lawyers make use of it. And the Ayurvedic doctors know something about Sankhya philosophy and Nyaya Vaisheshika because it's applicable to the practice of medicine. Few specialists. But what impact does the study, teaching, and debate of the Vedanta Sutra have on anybody's life in this modern age? Except for a few sannyasis who are interested to study it and a few professors who have no faith in it, nobody cares. You may know the name Vedanta Sutra, but nobody, who here knows more than a few sutras of the Vedanta? Who's, some of you have studied the Vedanta. But what are you going to do with it? You're going to write a commentary on Vedanta Sutra. Who's going to read it? How is it going to change anybody's life? It's of academic interest. Bhagavatam is different. Bhagavatam is empowered to change people's lives in the modern age. Vedanta Sutra is there, but it's for professional philosophers. And the professional philosophers nowadays are all useless nonsense. Speculators. They don't know what to do with Vedanta Sutra. They can't take advantage of it because they're speculators and not very smart, the professional philosophers. Nachasav Vishir, Yasya Matamna Binnam. Nobody's considered a decent philosopher unless he rejects what his teacher taught and makes up something new. I went to Columbia University. In the first year, there are two required courses. One in humanities, where you study Western literature, and the other one is Contemporary Civilization, I think was the name of it. Anyway, in that course, you study philosophy, modern philosophy, starting with Pascal and all the philosophers after that. You just, every day. So I went to the first day of the course, and we looked at, actually it wasn't Pascal, it was Descartes, René Descartes. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. He was very skeptical of the superstitious medieval philosophy with all of its religious speculations and nitpicking. So he wanted to remake philosophy on a rational basis. So he decided, I'm not going to accept anything on faith. I'm going to start not assuming anything. And let's see what I can come up with. So with a very radical approach of not assuming or accepting anything on faith, he said, well, here I am, doubting everything. So I'm thinking. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I must exist. That was the beginning of his philosophy. And he came up with a few things beside that. So we studied in the first day of the course, René Descartes' analysis of ontology. What exists, what's real, and how do you know anything? It's epistemology. Which is very interesting. I thought, this is an interesting course. It's valuable. This René Descartes was smart. He got some good ideas. Then I came in on Wednesday for the second class of the course. And the professor said, okay, today we're going to move on to the next philosopher, and he's going to show us how to reject everything that René Descartes said. What's the use then, I thought. That I lost my interest in that course on the second day. Because you learn a philosopher, you trust him, and then the next day you knock him down and replace him with somebody else. Where's tradition? Where's any standard, substantial knowledge? But that's what you have in the Vedic system. You don't criticize your teachers, tear them apart, knock them down, and make up your own philosophy. That's not the Vedic system of education. If you don't believe what the teacher of this or that school is teaching, then don't go to his school. But once you become a member of the school, you're expected to be faithful. Just like in the high school, you go to the football game and you root for your team, your school's team. If you root for the other team, then everyone will beat you up. Yeah, so similarly, you join a school of philosophy, you're supposed to be loyal to it. Not for notoriety, make up your own philosophy and defeat your teachers. Not decent way to be a student, to make your teacher into an enemy and destroy him. So at least in the Vedic tradition, there's a respect for tradition, respect for teachers. So Vyasadeva is the supreme teacher in this age, for this age, although he lived just before the beginning of this age. He's given us such a tradition of substantial knowledge. He's given us the Vedas in a form that somebody at least can try to understand. He's given us his own contributions, the Vedanta Sutra, which explains the apparently contradictory statements of the Upanishads and shows how it is all actually discussing the one absolute truth, not many different topics. There is one absolute truth, and he proves it. And he shows how the philosophy of the Upanishads is the perfect philosophy. And he compares it to other imperfect philosophies and defeats all the other philosophies and establishes Vedanta, the Upanishad philosophy, as the actual way to know the absolute truth. So Vyasadeva has done this in the Vedanta Sutra, Brahma Sutra. And then for people who can't understand such elevated topics, he's written the Mahabharata and Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam is for the Vaishnavas. Mahabharata is for the other people, basically. There's apparent differences, discrepancies between the Mahabharata and Bhagavatam. One reason is that they're for different audiences. We also respect Mahabharata, we also read it. But our primary authority is Srimad Bhagavatam. If there's any apparent contradiction, we take the version of the Bhagavatam. We give that precedence. Mahabharata, other Puranas, we have great respect for, and sometimes we read them. Often we use various statements from them. But our primary authority is Srimad Bhagavatam. Because it's Puranam Amolam. It is perfect authority. There is nothing misleading or confusing in the Bhagavatam. Non-devotees cannot understand. Mahabharata may be understandable by people who don't have any serious interest in liberation. People who are very satisfied to stay within the material world and don't even know much about any other world. So what is the ultimate goal presented? Goal of life presented in the Mahabharata. What did the Pandavas achieve in the end? Swargarohanam, elevation to heaven. And that's it. No concept, except for when you look in the small part, which is the Bhagavad Gita. No concept of paras tasmatu bhavonyo, vyakto vyakta sanatanaha. No idea of an eternal world. Basically in Mahabharata. The world to be attained is heaven, the home of Indra and the demigods. So that's to be something that can be understood and accepted by materialistic people. We know, well, the Pandavas, Arjuna and his brothers are eternal associates of Krishna in the material world. So they do stay in the material world, but for a transcendental purpose. But they're always with Krishna. They're not just sitting with Indra in heaven, watching the apsaras dance. They're with Krishna, wherever Krishna goes. Bhagavatam does not present any inferior concept of what is the goal and perfection of life. Bhagavatam presents pure love, pure devotion for Krishna, or at least for Krishna's expansions, Swamsha expansions, as the only proper goal of life, the only proper fulfillment of the potential of human life. Even liberation to Vaikuntha, even going to the same planet where the Lord lives, is not equal to the ultimate goal of prema, love for Krishna. Mama janmani, janmanishvare bhavatad bhaktirahoy tikitvayi. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, I have only one requirement, one demand. I must have bhaktirahoy tiki, unmotivated devotional service for you, devotion for you. Arrange, please, that in my life after life, janmani, janmanishvare, I have this pure devotion. This is Lord Chaitanya's request, and he's showing us the attitude that his devotees should have. No interest in anything material, not much interest even in liberation. Let me take birth again and again and remain in the material world if that's what Krishna wants. But I must have pure devotion for him, pure love. Not that there's no desire, but the one desire of a pure devotee is I must have. Please, I cannot be satisfied without bhakti-rahoituki tvayi. That's ultimately what Vyasadeva is out to teach, especially after he will be instructed in the next chapter, chapters 5 and 6, by his guru Narada. Vyasadeva will be reoriented to presenting Srimad Bhagavatam, Anarto pasamam shakshad, bhakti yoga madhoksaje, lokas ya janato vidvams, chakre satvata samhitam. People are ignorant in Kali Yuga. They don't know what the purpose of life is. They don't know what is actually the goal and the perfection. They think it's amassing a lot of money, getting powerful, being healthy for 200 years, having grandchildren and great-grandchildren and great-great-great-grandchildren. What is it Prabhupada said? There's a Bengali saying. Natai, natai, something, swarga, shala. I don't know. If you see your grandson's grandson, if you live long enough to see your grandchildren's grandchildren, you automatically go to heaven. So some people think that's the goal of life. To have 10 children, 100 grandchildren, and 1,000 great-grandchildren. And if you have great-great-great-great-grandchildren, six generations, who knows how many there are. That's considered a perfection by some people. But Bhagavatam rejects all these kaitava dharmas, cheating ideas of the success of life, and promotes only pure bhakti. And Vyasadeva, especially after he was told to do this by his guru, he made that his purpose. And he accomplished that purpose by composing or presenting Srimad Bhagavatam. This is just the preamble to that. This is chapter 4, describing Vyasadeva compiling or organizing the Vedas, writing the Mahabharata. In the next chapter, there's a brief mention of Vedanta Sutra in the beginning. But that's simply what he did in his early career. His magnus opus, the culmination of his work, was the presentation of Srimad Bhagavatam. Just go ahead and read the next chapter, and you'll see that that's what's going to happen. Vyasadeva is going to be instructed by his guru that after doing all this, after organizing the Vedas and compiling Mahabharata and Vedanta Sutra, you're still not satisfied. You feel incomplete. And because you have not adequately described the glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Yata dharma dayas charta munivar yanakirtata natata vasudevasya mahima yanuvarnita. You've described dharma, artha, kama, moksha in all these books you've put together, but you have not sufficiently glorified the Personality of Godhead. That you must make up for this mistake by composing Srimad Bhagavatam. That's what the Bhagavatam says. That's what we'll be reading in the next chapter. Haribol. Any questions or comments? Yes.
I wanted to ask what you were saying about the scientists and knowledge. And Srila Prabhupada says if you're listening Mayavadis and mundane scientists, you will become contaminated. And so many Karma Mishra, Jnana Mishra, Yoga Mishra Bhaktas maybe in congregation. Now we have so many big congregation and new devotees, yes, that are still contaminated. And my experience is that when I'm in the street or just congregation people, they most like to speak. They are not listening, not hearing. And where is the limit and how to differentiate that association? Who is contaminated with what?
Well, you can assume most everybody is. People who have not practiced devotional service, who have not gotten the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, they're misled, almost all of them. All of them. So they want to talk, you have to shut their mouth. Stick a sweet ball in it. Give them prasadam, shut them up that way. Yeah. Unless they're so rude that they talk while they're eating. But give them prasadam. They don't want to hear, so get them ready to hear by prasadam and invite them to the kirtan. Or take the kirtan out in the streets. Let them hear that. Let them get prasadam. Then that'll soften them up. That'll purify them. And if they're good people, eventually they'll be ready to hear something.
Even some of them are becoming devotee and still he's contaminated by that, by some speculation, the yes, karma mishra, jnana mishra. And what is the limit? Sometimes he meets it in vyasasana and
the limit is that none of it's tolerated. We don't tolerate any mishra anything in our process. No mishra anything. Dharma kaitava trope, project, dharma projita, kick it out. So at least someone is becoming a devotee. That means he has faith in somebody's, some devotee's authority. Maybe not all the devotees, but he's willing to listen to somebody. So that somebody has to educate him. That, okay, time to give up all these other dharmas. Sarva dharma pratityaja. You know, this is the message of the Gita, to sum it up in one verse. So those new people who are becoming devotees, that means they have faith in somebody as spiritual authority. They're listening to some devotee. So that devotee who they're willing to listen to should tell them, now time to give up all this mixed stuff, all these mixed dharmas. Because that's what we're not accommodating mixed devotional service. It's not our process. You want that? Go somewhere else. But rather, we don't send them away. We just tell them, Yeah, let's give up this nonsense and practice pure devotional service. Then you can be happy. Why not be happy? Now you're confused and miserable still. You're chanting Hare Krishna, you're still confused and miserable. You got so many things on your brain, so many anxieties. Why not give up all this mixed dharma and become happy? Not just new people. Look at people who have been around for decades who are still got wrong things on their brain. That's a little harder. A new person, you can be the authority. Because he's been around for 2 months and you've been around for 2 years. But if someone's been around for 20 years, then who is he going to listen to? He's heard everything already. That's much more difficult. So get them while they're young. Get them while they're new. Before they become stuck in their ways. Change them before it's too late. Okay? Hi, Griva Prabhu.
I read from Prabhupada Rasayana book. One Choveji, he came to meet Srila Prabhupada in his quarter, Vrindavan. He want to meet Prabhupada and talk with Prabhupada. And Prabhupada said, okay, you can sit, then after we can discuss.
Yes.
Then he just wanted to discuss about Atharva Veda.
Yes.
Then after some time discussion, he asked, who is the Supreme? Then he couldn't reply properly. He had one son. He was a professor. He asked how many Vedas. Even he could not say that how many Vedas and name of the Vedas. Then Prabhupada called Saraswati. You know who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead? Then Saraswati replied that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Prabhupada, after Prabhupada, he said this title, no, Choveji Goswami, this is nowadays it is such a professional way. But people, they don't understand this thing. They are smoking cigarettes, drinking wine, but still they are considered as Goswami. But in our case, we also intoxicated that we think ourselves that I am in a great position, I know something. So how we can maintain our really identity that we are really the servant of devotee?
To realize that we're servant of the servant. In other words, to develop the humility that's required. If you're proud of yourself, Janmaishwarya Shuta Shribir Edamana Badakpuman, Naivar Hatyabija Abhidatum Vai, Twama Kinchana Gotri. Krishna, you belong to those who don't have anything. Those who are proud of what they have, they cannot approach you sincerely. So that pride must be given up. How do you become humble? By serving. By serving Guru. By making sacrifice to satisfy the Guru. Give up your conception of what satisfies you and work, even if it's painful and unpleasant, to satisfy the Guru. Then you'll become humble. So Guru and Vaishnavas. Serve the Guru and Vaishnavas. Don't just service your own whims. Service the Guru and Vaishnavas. Then you'll develop proper attitude. Okay? Damodar Gopal.
I'm trying to understand a few things. But first one is, it seems that there's this movement in ISKCON that, this tendency of trying to be recognized, have a certificate from a school, recognized by a school, that what we're teaching is recognized by this university. What's the use of that? And
to establish your material life. You still have interest in material life, so therefore you want a diploma. It has no spiritual purpose. You're going to present your diploma to your guru? He'll laugh at it. You know, you're going to present it to Srimati Radharani as your ticket to go be introduced to Krishna? I have my master's degree? You'll be laughed at.
My understanding is that we want to present to intelligent people that we have deep knowledge without going through the normal system.
How many intelligent people are there?
Okay, so-called intelligent.
No, really, you know, people who can actually understand anything. You know, few. How many people do we need to preach to them? A few hundred people. We need thousands of devotees to preach to a few hundred people. You know, some devotees should preach to the academics. How many academic devotees do we need? There are only about 200, 300 Indologists in the whole world. So how many devotees do we need who are expert to preach to them? We need 2,000 devotees to preach to 2,000 scholars, 200 scholars? So some devotees need to preach to the academics. But I think we got devotees going to school because they want job security. Mm. Which is, you know, it's also allowable. But call a spade a spade. It's okay, you know, you need security. You're not ready to trust Krishna 100%? Okay. You need financial security. Most of us do. But some people can live without it. Some really surrendered devotees can live without financial security. But you're going to school for financial security. Be honest about it. You really want to preach, study Bhagavatam. Don't study it with Professor So-and-so. He'll just, you know, kill it. Do the best he can to kill the Bhagavatam. Study the Bhagavatam with the devotees. If you really want to preach to everybody.
But those who have interest in preaching, I mean...
To academics. Go ahead and do it.
Academics.
Go ahead and do it.
Or maybe sometimes it's not so necessary to just to preach to the academics, but just to the students.
Okay, go ahead and do it. Okay. But we don't need, like, all of our intelligent devotees to do that. We don't need everybody to do it. We don't need everybody to go back to the university.
And what it's going to do, even if we...
It's like the what's it called? The lemmings? They all follow one another jumping off the cliff. It's silly. Why do they all have to kill themselves?
What's the purpose or what's the goal of just preaching to the academics?
Well, if you can make one into a devotee, good luck. Maybe you can make some of their students into devotees.
I think that's...
Or make them friends so they'll write a nice letter about ISKCON. I don't know. But, you know, Prabhupada said your preaching is successful if the person you're preaching to is ready to surrender like Arjuna did. So if you can make a professor or a student surrender like Arjuna to become an actual devotee, then you're successful. Otherwise, it's just public relations. You know, getting favorable remarks from people and maybe helping us when we're in trouble. But that's public relations. That's not really hardcore preaching. Maybe I'm talking too sharply. I'm sorry.
Like, it seems this tendency also to... Let's mix in society and show that we have something nice.
Mixing in society is very dangerous business.
Yeah.
Prabhupada didn't want us mixing too much in this cat and dog society. You end up becoming a cat or a dog, or something in between.
And it seems, yeah. I mean, that's what
mixing with society. I don't think we should do that only as much as absolutely necessary. We may have to go into society. I wouldn't mix with it too much. It rubs off. You know, you don't need 3 televisions in your house.
It seems that this is becoming a little bit prominent because...
Because it's Kali Yuga. Yeah. You get a little loose or a little, you know, lax on your dedication, and Kali takes over. Just give him a chance and he'll have his influence on you.
Thank you.
Okay. Bhagirathi Prabhu.
You explained about the, that's the, there is some contradiction between the Bhagavatam and
apparent. Seems apparent, to be contradiction.
Yes, yes. So some may argue that, look at your scripture, that even the same author already makes some contradiction. So how we present an argument to defeat?
It's not contradictions. The Parikshit, who said, "Let the snake bird bite me," just go on chanting Krishna's glories. And the Parikshit who decided, when he heard the snake bird was going to come bite him, decided to build a fortress to protect himself. They're not the same person. They're two different Parikshits that lived in different times. That's our explanation.
And what
so it's not a contradiction. The Puranas and Itihasas describe events in different days of Brahma, different Manvantaras. So there is apparent confusion, but it can be sorted out.
And what about sometime in some section of Mahabharata, it said that all the four Pandavas, except Yudhishthira, they went to hell.
Oh, just temporarily. They saw hell. Because they had slight faults in their character, supposedly. Therefore, they had to get a glimpse of hell. And then while they were down there, they saw that Duryodhana was sitting in heaven. But then they ended up going back. They after a scare, you know, a short scare, they were sent to heaven. Prahlad Nandaprabhu? This is the last question because breakfast is ready to be served.
But some part of Mahabharata is being matched with Bhagavatam also. So how you should consider when somebody will ask then, like Parikshit Maharaj in this case, that...
Yes.
How should give answer to them?
When there is apparent contradiction?
Yeah, I mean like some part of Mahabharata is being matched with Bhagavatam also.
Is what?
Bhagavatam.
Yes. What is? Some parts match.
Matched.
Yes. Why not?
So like here there is a contradiction in case of Parikshit Maharaj.
Because sometimes Bhagavatam, the two books are describing the same events. And sometimes they're describing events that occurred in different ages, so they're not the same. But there's lots of things that do match, because they're both describing, you know, the same events. That's okay. There's a lot of agreement, and there's some little bit of disagreement. Not so much disagreement, some. And the disagreement can be explained if you study it carefully. Anyway, if someone is that interested in looking at the books that he's asking such a question, say, well, here, you really have to study these books carefully. Take this complete set of the Bhagavatam. It's just 7,000 rupees, $200. Take it and read the whole thing, and then you'll understand it. Yes? Yes, ma'am. Last question.
You mentioned that... Pandavas are eternal associate of Lord Krishna in my material world. So for example, suppose Krishna left this place and he go to another planet. And what it's mentioned in Mahabharata that
they went to heaven.
They went to heaven after that.
It didn't say how long they stayed there. It doesn't say how long they stayed there. They went to heaven. They went to hell too, but not for very long. Then they went to heaven in between Krishna being in one place and the next, and then they joined Krishna. It's just transited. They were in the transit lounge. That's all. Okay, so we stop here. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jaya.